Hello, welcome to this episode of 10,000 Posts. It's the show about how everything is posting. My name is Hussein.
My name is Phoebe.
And this week we are very delighted to be joined to talk about platform work in the gig economy by Dr. Adam Badger. He is a lecturer at Newcastle University's Geography Department. A lot of his work focuses on platform work, resistance, and the city. Adam, how's it going?
Yeah, good. Yeah, thanks for having me along. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And the reason why we sort of brought you up is because we talk a little bit about, or we talk quite a lot about like the gig economy and the way that it sort of affects like our online experiences and the way that like as users in particular, we kind of, you know, we can sort of see the ways in which like gig economy apps affect, you know, just have had like material effects and the ways in which they have distorted and if not decayed some of our like lived experiences. Recently, however, there was an important story about delivery drivers and Uber Eats drivers, workers who have been protesting against the companies that contract them. I was going to say hire, but actually part of the biggest problem is that they don't really hire them. So a few weeks ago, more than 3,000 drivers went on strike. I'm not sure about the exact numbers of that. So I guess like to begin with, Adam, like, You had sort of been keeping an eye on this, and a lot of your work sort of has focused around like resistance by workers to gig economy apps. I wondered whether you could talk for people who aren't familiar with like what's gone on, what is the situation, and why did so many drivers strike over the past few weeks, and why are they continuing to sort of like threaten strikes against Deliveroo and Uber Eats?
Yeah, of course. So there was a huge strike in recent weeks, spearheaded by many of the Brazilian riders in the community in London. For anyone that doesn't know, a lot of gig workers in the UK particularly have Brazilian heritage, some Latin American heritage, and some many like Italians and Western Europeans, but large Brazilian cohort, who basically, after years and years of pay cuts, have said that's enough. To paint a kind of broad brush picture of what's been happening, really. You know, in 2016, so I was a gig worker. I used to deliver food myself. And back in 2016, it was the first strike of its kind, really. And again, that was led by Brazilian workers. You know, so just for the argument of migrants decrease wages, I think it's another point of evidence to say, no, migrants actually step in and often increase wages, stop the decline in conditions. Mm-hmm. So yeah, worth saying, it's really important to like push that narrative, you know. But broadly, back in 2016, workers were paid £7 an hour for a company like Deliveroo, plus £1 per job on top of that they did. And then Deliveroo changed the game. They said, what we want to do is pay you a fixed rate for every job and no base. So the potential to earn more was higher, but the potential to earn nothing went from being an impossibility to something that became very real. The next change brought dynamic pricing. So dynamic pricing means that the price per job can vary. By factors unknown to the worker. So Deliveroo or Uber Eats' algorithm says this job is worth £2.80 or £2.70. You don't really know why. You know, it's roughly a mix of distance and time and how busy the system is, you know, that kind of surge pricing that we might be used to as customers. And what's been happening is that those rates started off really, really high, and now they've become lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. So a situation where in 2017, workers would get £4 at least for a job, we're now seeing rates as low as £2.50, £2.60, which has kind of crossed that threshold into unsustainable. What we saw was a lot of work intensification as pay decreases, but now we're kind of reaching the point where workers can't intensify their labor anymore. There's not much more they can do to squeeze extra pennies of efficiency out of their day. And so we've reached breaking point, essentially. And these workers kind of organized against that to try and make that clear, both to customers and to the platforms. Not that the platforms don't already know.
I think Phoebe, were you going to say something?
No, I actually didn't know that there is a dynamic pay structure within delivery apps. And I think that is something which is quite important, because part of keeping the brute nature of their working lives obscure to the workers who are doing it is such an important and I think under explored aspect of it, particularly since access to wages is a determinant on another sort of functionally arbitrary structure, which is the reviews and the ratings and the tip giving. And that's definitely part of it, but it's not as discussed with the same kind of level of intensity. And I think it's a really important point to bring out.
Yeah, on the dynamic pay, basically that's what we've seen all platforms doing globally, or many platforms doing globally. They used to have fixed rates, and every time they'd reduce the fixed rates to become more profitable as far as the investors were concerned, you know, showing a route towards profit, then sorry, I got totally distracted by the balloons.
Yeah, no, so if you make certain gestures, are you recording on a Mac?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you make certain gestures on a Mac, then for some reason Zencastr does that. And I didn't know that it did this until the other day when I was recording with my other co-host, and it understood that he was like giving a thumbs up or something. So try a thumbs up, see if it does it. Ah, interesting. Mm. So different Macs do different things.
Okay.
Also obscure to the user.
Yeah.
It feels very vibes. Yeah. dynamic. Yeah. Dynamic, like, what do you call it? Animations. Feels very like vibes driven.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in a job once, actually, to be fair. I was in a job recently where they were announcing redundancies on Zoom.
Oh, no.
The guy announcing them didn't know. And he literally, 2 seconds after he announced it, balloons. And it was just like, couldn't have been worse. Like, everyone was just like, God. What the fuck?
Oh my god! Yeah. So you were saying
dynamic pricing. What we've seen globally is platforms moving towards a dynamic pricing model. Because in the past, every time there was a fixed rate of pay that they would decrease to try and demonstrate, you know, a path to profitability towards investors. Broadly, they were reducing labor cost. Workers would strike, or they would stop working, or they would go and work for a different platform they work for, because that's a very kind of clear bang, you're earning less money now, you know. And then what we saw really around 2018 is the early movers went towards dynamic pricing, and they started with very, very high rates. That's the way they sold it to the workers, you know, you're earning more now than ever before. But over time, it's like just shaving pennies off a job. So you don't feel it, but when you look back at your payslip now versus the payslip 12 months ago, you're earning 2/3 as much. You know, if you look back at one from 2 years ago, you're earning hardly anything in comparison. So what I try and say to people, you know, the analogy of the frog in water, where it's like you put a frog in cold water, you heat it up gently, it doesn't realize it's cooked. Whereas if you drop a frog in boiling water, it's like, ouch, and tries to jump out. The platforms are basically treating their workers like those frogs in this instance. They're trying to gently change it and slowly move the kind of territory under their feet, which when you combine that with a massive level of staff turnover, means that the kind of worker's memory of what fees can be and should be is lost. So, you know, people leave the platform when the fees get a little bit too low, but new workers come in and they're only used to it being £3.50 a job. They might leave when it becomes £3.28 a job, you know, and then a new set of workers will come in where the kind of ceiling is £3.28 rather than the floor. So there's that kind of worker kind of institutional amnesia almost about what a rate should be because of the high level of turnover.
Presumably that kind of deliberate obscurantism as well is deliberately set up to prevent people from organizing and making demands. Because if you say, oh, it's... Yeah, but it's not a person that's made this decision. There's nobody to appeal to, and we can always replace you if you withdraw your labor. So you can just say, oh well, it's the algorithm, and treat the algorithm like it's a kind of magic spell, as opposed to a matter of policy that has been coded by a person in order to get people out of their wages.
Exactly. There's this kind of naturalization of the algorithm. You'd be like, well, it's maths, man. It's science. Mm. And he's like, it's science based on, based on this kind of extractive practice, you know. Mm. So the argument I often have with people that are developers or are kind of the hardcore data scientists, who we need to understand how that works as well, right? It's critical as a critical social scientist, I need to know how some bits of the data systems work. And the kind of piece that we get to is that broadly it's like a snowball. You start up at the top of the mountain and that shape of the snowball, you roll it down. You know, like in cartoons where there's like limbs flying out of the snowball that's rolling down the mountain. That's kind of the data taking over. But the people that start it off in its trajectory and kind of form its initial shape in many ways dictate what it'll look like at the bottom of the mountain. And so there are some things that are just based on the data, you know, in scare quotes, which doesn't always come across in audio. But that data is already pre-coded and pre-contextualized by a kind of profit-driven system that is often looking to exploit the workers that are generative of that data.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I think you sort of touched on it, I guess like algorithms is sort of like really, and sort of what an algorithm is in this context, to the degree that like, and we know we've spoken about this in other contexts where, you know, an algorithm is often sort of framed as being kind of this all-knowing, like almost like a theological, like almost like a deity. But the reality is that like an algorithm is something that is designed by humans and it works like in particular, it works like in particularly socially, like economically contextual ways. But for so long, and especially for like dry, like for these types of like, or for any type of gig economy worker, the idea that you are, you know, that your sort of livelihood is directed by this nebulous algorithm, and therefore, like, there is no, like, we know that like this is a way of sort of deterring liability from bosses and corporations and like the people who make money through these algorithms and who continue to make money through these algorithms. One of the things that I found interesting when I was researching this episode, and this was from a recent dispatch from Callum Kant in Vissel's magazine, when he like during his like reporting of the strikes, was also the ways in which like the drivers, what the drivers were boycotting, and you know, the idea that like a lot of their work also involved having to interact with other gig economy workers, particularly those within like dark kitchens. And I wondered whether like you, like how, I guess this like brings me to a question about how like food delivery has changed, like since the time that you were working in it, but also since the time that like this sort of became a phenomenon. Because I guess before the idea was like, okay, this is just sort of a way of kind of expanding the amount of delivery drivers, and that I remember the argument being that, oh, this will benefit small restaurants who can't afford to like bring their like hire their own delivery staff. Now they can sort of, you know, they can sort of deliver to more people. And so it was framed as being like this way of helping small restaurants. But now like what you really have is like a sort of network that consists of gig economy workers that work in dark kitchens that like make sort of generic food for corporations to then be delivered by gig economy workers who face like extremely dangerous conditions, like, or more and more dangerous conditions now in order to like deliver like a coffee or like a, you know, a lukewarm hamburger. And so I wondered whether you could talk a little bit, like partly based on your experience, but also just like the ways in which you have seen food delivery as in the context of a gig economy, like how has that changed over the past decade?
Yeah, for sure. The change has been massive, right? Like, I think there's this, and it's good you're doing it, there's this trend for people to talk about these companies as new somehow. And it's like, they're not new. They're nearly a decade old, right? Like if they were a Labrador, they'd be nearly dead by now. So it's
Is that how you do all your calculations?
It's how you do
it. The
average lifespan of a Labrador.
Yeah. I don't know why I chose Labrador. I don't even have a dog.
It is a good point though, because like you still see like the justifications that like, you know, your Just Eats and stuff do, especially when they talk about how they don't, well, especially how when they have to admit that they don't really make any money, is that like they'll say, we're a startup, right? Like, ooh, we're just a startup.
We're a tiny little startup.
Don't get mad at us.
Don't get mad at me. We're only as old as a very elderly Labrador.
When you're yelling at us, you're yelling at a 10-year-old child what the amounts of the argument. Anyway, please continue.
What I've learned is that 10-year-old children yell back, right? That's part of the problem. I'm not putting that on my CV. It's definitely a case that these companies aren't new. And I think what's really interesting as well is, you know, people talk about the resistance as new, and it's not. And what we're talking about now, and it's good that we've got this space to do it, is resistance strategies that are built over time. you know, we might talk about those a bit later in terms of how those things have changed. But in terms of how the platforms have changed, food delivery massively, massively, massively. But it's important to say that a lot of it is a very urban phenomenon. Really, the only company that has big extent into the rural or kind of small towns market is Just Eat, because they've cornered that bit of the market that is just providing an online menu service, and then the restaurant can pay for its own courier to go and do the delivery. Deliveroo and others offer something similar, but not on the same scale. So Just Eat is profitable in a way that other companies aren't, because they have that kind of constant income from the rural market. But what we're really talking about here is the urban market that's been changing and the city that's been changing with it. And it's significant. I mean, everyone, you know, for better or worse, will know what the inside of a McDonald's look like. And if you think about how even just a massive chain like McDonald's that really know how to streamline and orient a food business, basically, right? They do lots of things that are terrible, but what they are good at is like streamlining a business for flipping burgers and making food. They've changed the whole internal architecture of most of their restaurants and cities, right? So you have a pickup point, and then you have delivery couriers coming to that. They can mix with the regular customers, et cetera, because they recognize the size of the delivery market and how they have to change their entire operation, which has, you know, been a very long time in the fine tuning in order to facilitate its growth. So I think that's quite interesting to see that happening across you know, urban space and restaurant space. It's also an emptying out of restaurants. You know what I mean? That's like, we've all been places. I used to often, when I was working, you'd pick up and you'd be like, there'd be no customers in there. It's just, you know, fellow bros in sweaty, high vis, basically, which totally changes the restaurant kind of landscape. In terms of what you're saying about algorithm, I think this is really interesting and how they become these godlike structures, right? So I would speak to workers often who would talk about the algorithm gods that they would try to please. And often there would be almost like sacrifices made to them in terms of working longer than you wanted to, making sure you're performing as the most efficient you could, et cetera, et cetera. So it's this kind of, weird, almost like Old Testament deity relationship, you know what I mean? Where it's if you do something wrong, you're worried they're going to punish you, and you don't quite know how and for what, but you know that you do risk a punishment. In the case of Deliveroo, that god is quite literally Danny DeVito. So Deliveroo's earliest algorithm was named Louis after Danny DeVito's character in Taxi Driver, where he's just like telling people where to go. He's a bit brash. He's quite like a crude instrument, right? Like, he just tells people where to go and what to do. When they moved over to a much more sophisticated labor distribution algorithm and kind of order management system, they changed the name to Frank. So Danny DeVito's character out of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Anyone's ever watched that show knows that Frank is awful. He's like the most Machiavellian, really not a nice guy, very, very self-serving. So I find that quite interesting. As obviously what is a joke among millennials in a white-collar office, I think actually really represents that what the shift in the algorithm is doing, which is keeping more secret and, you know, giving others less agency to look after themselves in the service of itself. It's kind of odd. A lot of the pages that went around that release have now disappeared. So I don't think they're particularly proud of it now that they're a couple of years further along. But it's interesting to think about what that did as well, right? So in the earlier days of action against Deliveroo, at least, strike action was oriented around something they called the zone center. And the zone center was where you had to go as a worker to be able to log on when you were not on a job. So when you had no food in your bag, you'd have to return to the zone center to be able to get more work. And broadly, when the platform was quiet, that was a great place for organizing workers, right? Because there's people that are idle. They have nothing else to do because there's no jobs. They're not getting paid because there's no jobs. So they're frustrated and they're all together, which means you can turn that kind of individual consciousness into a group consciousness very quickly. You know, simple questions. This is rubbish, isn't it? What's going on today? Why aren't they giving us any jobs? Blah, blah, blah. And after some very relatively successful strikes, Deliveroo got rid of the zone center and they changed the labor distribution algorithm. So instead of just being the closest to the restaurant, now it would take data from all of the previous times. Say you're ordering something from Nando's. Say you're ordering a chicken burger from Nando's, right? They have data on how long it takes that chicken burger to be cooked at peak and non-peak times throughout the day. So they can know, in theory, how long it's going to take the chef and front of house to get that from order placement through to being sat waiting on the pass to leave. So now, instead of sending the closest rider, which is the old system, they would send a rider that they think is that many minutes away. Which, if it works on paper, should be brilliant, right? It should make everyone more busy. But of course, it doesn't work. People are left and saddled with very long wait times. And now you don't even know where to wait in the city to maximize your chance of getting jobs. So I used to work in EC for different platforms, which is broadly East Central. So Shoreditch, Whitechapel, City of London. When I was desperate for money, I used to know that I could go and wait in a specific place and I would get at least some jobs. Whereas now you could camp outside of Nando's and be the closest one. It doesn't mean you're going to get any work there. So that also disempowers workers in how they operate in the city, right? It's where do they choose to wait? Where do they choose to linger? Where do they choose to position themselves? And what grows up then is a kind of folkloric knowledge about what works. Like for me, I would always wait on Hanbury Street. So this is deeply geographical, right? Like it's deeply kind of wrapped in the city. Hanbury Street is nestled between the markets to the one side and then Brick Lane to the other. So it's all that kind of culturally interesting enough food that office workers that are in big corporations want to have for lunch, but feels not too risky, right? It's not like too authentic.
Yeah.
And so you know you're going to get orders. And for me, I was like, this is the place that's in between those two locations. So that kind of changed my read of the city when the algorithm changed like that. It's worth saying as well, sorry, I know this is a long point, so please do chop and cut this when it comes to it. But in terms of looking at, you mentioned the dark kitchens. I think this is really vital, right? So dark kitchens broadly, as far as I can tell, are a route to product diversification from these organizations. So it lets them become a landlord to start with. It allows them to have many, many restaurants on a small space. So it improves their customer offering. And it also centralizes workers into one point. Interestingly, just like the zone center, that is a great place. If you want to picket somewhere and you've got an atomized workforce that is spread around the city, go to the place where all the restaurants are, right? Because most workers are going to go into one of these additions kitchens or dark kitchens at some point, and you can spread the message to them there. So there must have been a cost-benefit analysis at these companies of like what the risk is that comes with these kind of places. But what they do is, again, think about it in terms of data architectures, data systems. Every single order that goes through one of those systems produces a little bit of data which says about what's popular. What do people want? What's the highest markup items? You know, how can we position something on a virtual menu that makes it more likely to be bought? And really, companies like Deliveroo and Uber Eats are putting themselves into a position where they will be able to open up their own places. They haven't done it yet, but I'm very kind of, how can I put it? I'm relatively certain that that's something they will do in the next few years in a desperate bid for profitability, because they know what people want. They know what tastes are like in Hackney versus Leeds versus Edinburgh versus, you know, Birmingham. Like, they know what flavors go down well. They know what the customer base wants. So why don't they just take more of that production chain into their own system? I don't know. And I think it's where currently they're building a suite of data that will be big enough to do that. And then if we have Deliveroo-owned and Uber Eats-owned restaurants everywhere, it kind of changes the face and kind of leads to greater monopolization, right? These companies want monopoly of the delivery sector, but really the only companies that can afford to benefit on these platforms are also the big players. They're the Wagamamas, the Five Guys, the Nandos. Little players can't afford the 30% overheads that the platforms take. So really it's this general push towards the creation of big, monolith, powerful brands in the city. And homogenization that comes with it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Do you have a sense of why they're willing to risk there being places where workers can gather and workers can easily pick it? Is it a sort of coalescence of factors, or is it sort of one really obvious one? Yeah, that I'm just not thinking
I think
of.
It's a coalescence. So, for example, I live near Poplar now and Canary Wharf and all that kind of area of East London. Real estate is really expensive there, and not all restaurants have a footprint. And if they do, their kitchens aren't big enough to service the demand of, you know, that higher percentage of people with disposable income that might be in that postcode. So it allows them to do it, and it allows them to offer things to restaurants that they couldn't otherwise offer. it's also interesting that there's something that's outside of their control, which there are private dark kitchens opening up. So there's some that are owned by platforms. In the case of like Deliveroo Editions, if you see that on a Deliveroo app, that's a Deliveroo-owned dark kitchen. But there are other dark kitchens that aren't owned by the platforms, and they're opening up everywhere anyway. So it's kind of like, if it's going to happen, it may as well happen on their territory as anyone else's. Do you know what I mean? That probably is part of that dynamic. But you see all sorts in those. You know, I've picked up things for very, very expensive, what looked like very, very expensive steak restaurants on the app, and it's like the filthiest restaurant you've ever seen. And it's not like where you're expecting kind of £35 steak to be being picked up from. Why would you order that anyway, to have it come cold to your house? I don't quite understand. But So there's a lot that can be hidden in there. So if you're ever looking at stuff, you think, that sounds familiar, have a look at the address and see, put it in on Google Maps. You might get a totally different restaurant because they'll have like a different, they'll be renting half of their kitchen space. It's idle to other places as well.
Mm. I imagine also part of it is that companies like Deliveroo probably take for granted the fact that there's not terrific education and knowledge around labor organizing and around resistance. And also, if they make it very, very difficult to participate in any kind of collective bargaining, then what is functionally scab labor is just extremely easy just to bring in. And maybe they're kind of weighing up the people can't afford to be taking action against these companies, which is why I think that the recent strike action and the one before it, I think, is particularly heartening because it suggests that that's sort of not really true, and or certainly not true in the way that companies take for granted is necessarily true. And I think it also ties in to the point that you were making earlier about the incorrect assumptions about migrant labor driving down wages, when actually what seems to be the case in kind of material reality is that migrant workers are more likely to be approaching the labor market with this kind of grounding and with this sort of history of labor organizing behind them in the way that British workers just don't have, like deliberately just don't have.
Exactly. I mean, part of I used to be part of the union, still am part of the union that does a lot of organizing with these workers. So that's the IWGB, for anyone that doesn't know them. GMB also organize with them, but there's lots of kind of, I suppose, conflict in there as well and questions to be asked. But I mean, IWGB, for example, have a long history of migrant organizing, right? And really, really inspirational stuff that just isn't happening in lots of the rest of the labor market. So a lot of my time was spent working with cleaners in kind of central London universities and different places. And they're amazing, absolutely amazing. Like stories of broadly Latin American women that organize entire workforces, you know, men and women, but a lot of the time very, very strong women who organize entire workforces at a place and can lead the most exciting kind of strike action, both in terms of, it's people that they don't think are going to be striking, but it's also the pickets themselves are amazing. There's food, there's dancing, there's music, and that brings people in to something that makes kind of striking and collective action more approachable and not like this weird thing for crusty old geezers in pubs, but is like something that you feel like you can do and just join in with, you know, and I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I quite agree.
But yeah, just in terms of the strike action as well, I think it's interesting, really, for me, where this most recent strike action, we'll see it kind of what happens in the aftermath, you know, these next few months are really vital. It really, the last action of this kind was back in 2016, this kind of all-out strike action. And like you say, it's because workers don't have enough money to go out on all-out strikes anymore. Mm. You know, and the platforms know that. They know they're financially disempowered to that extent. So 2016, this really shows like a bookend of this era of platform work and platform kind of growing up, if that makes sense, and the changes that it's made. In between that, there was a massive shift in how people were resisting. So instead of 2016 was an all-out strike, there was a week of people stood outside the delivery offices in central London with megaphones trying to go in and negotiate and do all this kind of stuff. Very, very, in some ways, traditional, what we'd think of in terms of like a strike action. Since then, and because people aren't earning enough to be able to go out on that kind of action, what we're seeing is very, very targeted. They might be targeted at a specific restaurant chain. For example, Wagamama used to be notorious for having really long waits. So there'd be strikes only for Wagamama. Don't do Wagamama orders. And that's the idea there, is to put pressure on the restaurant as well as the platform to put pressure on the restaurant to make things better. Or there might be strikes against one platform, but riders are working for three or four. So you might take your turn on a picket line outside a McDonald's or a really popular place or a Editions Kitchen, a dark kitchen. And then you go off and do 2 hours for a different platform, because that means you can still afford to eat. You can still afford to put the roof over your head. You can still afford to, you know, make sure your family are looked after. So the kind of the competing forces in the market make it a particular kind of landscape for striking that we don't see in for want of a better word, traditional employment.
Yeah. And I imagine like a lot of that is also like, or how much of that is also just like also recognizing the sort of scale of the drivers, because I think, as sort of alluded to, a lot of these drivers are, you know, immigrants. A lot of these drivers, like, you know, may not, you know, they are less protected if like they are afforded any protection at all, and therefore, like, you know, these types of jobs are kind of the only things that they are able, like, but it's largely like one of the few ways in which they can actually like make a living. And so the idea of sort of like going on an all-out strike may be untenable for them. Like when I was reading some of the articles about the strike, one of the articles that came up, it was sort of talking about like fights between different delivery drivers, those who were like sort of protesting. Like I think this happened in a McDonald's actually, like where like some of the drivers were kind of like fighting with others because they didn't, some of them were on strike and others weren't. I didn't really go into details over like who was and who wasn't, but I imagine it's a sort of situation. If it's anything like the McDonald's near my house, for example, it may like be the case of the drivers who are taking on more dangerous jobs, who are taking on more jobs, are also those who, like, it is very clear that it is quite unlikely, but they probably have enough protection from the state that they could kind of feasibly, like, you know, carry out like, or like remove their labor in the sake of protest.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting. So some drivers are in that position that can't do it. And then other drivers that are exactly in that position, like, this is why I can't not do it. You know, this is why it's 100% all stakes. So that becomes the definite motivation for striking and kind of suffering some of that immediate financial pain. And in a way then, because you have two groups in a similar position taking different outcomes, that is also cause for frustrations, you know, which is difficult. But I think the community is broadly getting better at trying to work out how to do that. And trying to be a bit more empathetic. It's also where certain figures, like the, you know, there's a figure that says there's 500% staff turnover at Deliveroo and Uber Eats. I don't know how true it is. It's just figures I've seen from consultancy reports. For context, McDonald's has a staff turnover of about 130%. So it's a lot, lot higher. It means their whole staff of riders, in theory, turns over every 2 and a bit months. But in reality, what we're seeing is that there's a hardcore group of riders that are not turning over at all. They've been working there for 5-6 years. They do the majority of the work and are very, very entrenched in it. And then there's a significant larger group of drivers who do much less of the work for a much shorter period of time, and sometimes there's fractions come out between these two groups as well, right? So I'm not sure if it's quite still the case, but it always used to feel that it's that like 20% of the riders do 80% of the work and 80% of the riders do 20% of the work. I don't quite know how that sits now, because I've not been riding for those companies for a while, but that was always the case, it felt like, and that's where frictions could emerge, you know, for somebody for whom it's only beer money versus somebody for whom it's like everything, existential ability to continue paying rent and eating and keeping warm, that, you know, always leads to big problems. But yeah, so for me, the test is whatever things we're fighting for, we should be looking to support those who are most reliant on this work, right? If we can make it so that the tide rises those boats, the rest of it's less important. it needs to be that people can survive doing this. Whereas the platform's official line would be, well, it's supposed to be part of a portfolio career, you know? Yeah. Portfolio with what?
This is why I'm so incredible. I still haven't managed to think of a good, like a good alternative, but I am so keen to drive the term gig worker just out of common usage, because it's wandered into our thinking and speaking, basically kind of under the kind of undercover of night, pretty much, and it's the word of these platforms, and it's deliberate, and it's to make it sound cute and casual, and yeah, like you said, what you do for beer money, what you do as part of a kind of portfolio of employment. And the problem is it is really catchy. Like, it's really hard to think like we shouldn't be calling it that. Like, you can go around saying no. What we should call this is no rights precarious work is what we should call it. But that's not snappy. So there needs to be some kind of semantic replacement for the term gig work, which is more honest about what it actually is, I think. It's not like the most like important priority or anything, but just whenever I hear it, I just think we shouldn't say it, because it's doing what the platforms want us to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's semantics are important, right? Like, yeah. Semantics around employment, for example, in a legal sense, are very, very, very important. And where if we could win some ground there, things might look better. But we'll see. But it's interesting. I think it's whenever looking at the platform economy, like, a lot of the workers that you'll speak to are doing it kind of in spite of its issues. So really, the platform economy points at bigger problems in the labor market, particularly in this country under a hostile environment that hasn't gone away. And so many of the workers are like, this is the best option I have right now. There's nothing else. You know, there's this idea that circulates, which really gets on my nerves, and it's where I part ways with many, many academics and commentators on platform work, is the idea that platform work is somehow low or no skilled. You know, even the ILO would say it's categorized as that. There's somebody that's done it, like diving out between buses and like risking your life every day. This is not low skilled. It's just a nonsense straw man argument. But low skilled in our society means low value, right? And low value means low skilled. So for me, that's my kind of semantic war that I'm trying to fight, is around how we look at this work as skilled or not.
And that's a really important one as well. And even just like the distinction between skilled and unskilled labor is one with its own like extremely fraught sort of labor history, maybe less so in this country, but like definitely in the history of labor relations in the States, like the kind of distinction between skilled and unskilled labor. But I'm wondering whether in terms of like kind of semantic content, whether it's even worth saying, okay, but what do you mean by skills in this situation? Because do you mean something which you don't need any particular kind of qualification to do, or you don't need to have a particular level of experience to be able to do? But it doesn't mean that it's not difficult, and it doesn't mean that it's not challenging, and it also doesn't mean that it's not the kind of work which is kind of infrastructural and supportive. Like, you could argue that you couldn't get a job as a consultant unless you have a pretty good degree from a top university. But whether or not society would function without management consultants, I think, is something that, you know, one. You don't want to call anyone useless. However, there are people without whom society could not function, and who are kind of infrastructurally valuable. But that doesn't mean that you need a particular, often paid for skill set to be able to do this work. So maybe it's less about the distinction between skilled and unskilled, and more the distinction between between socially valued and not socially valued.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think it's where, you know, part of me, I try and use this argument intentionally to provoke debate in a way. I mean, there will be no debate on the value or not of management consultants from my perspective.
No offense to any management consultants. Again, like, we've all got bills, but, you know.
Yeah, straight up, even like the Empiric show, management consultants kill companies. Like, they basically strip them, and then the company fails or performs far worse after consultants have come in. Yeah, so I think in terms of skill and these workers, it's a really, like, I have this debate to try and provoke further debate in a way, just to get people to think about what's happening, because I think oftentimes what these platforms very successfully do is dehumanize the workers that are doing it. And part of that dehumanization is the de-skilling of them. You make them look like they're robots, and people start to drink the Kool-Aid, you know, people start to believe it. It might be that that's the case. Not necessarily anything other than subconsciously, but certainly within the subconscious. Because think about it, when you order from one of these platforms, what do you see is a representation. It's almost like a kind of discombobulated loading bar moving across your phone screen, right, from the driver to you, but it's just like a progress across the city. It doesn't capture any of the complexity of the work, so it's quite easy to fall into the mistake of thinking that the work is somehow simple when it's not. What I often find when I say this is people say, well, platform couriers are really replaceable. That means that it can't be that low skilled. They don't have any qualifications. But frankly, being a barrister is replaceable. There's way too many graduates to do it. It doesn't mean it's low skilled, you know. Or being a bike courier is manual labor. Therefore, it's not skilled. Only intellectual labor is. Well, being a surgeon is manual labor. It doesn't mean it's low skilled. So I think it's just about trying to butt up against some of these arguments that keep coming out about the nature of the skill of this work, and by extension, the humanity of the workers that are doing it, because they're rendered invisible by the platform. Where that becomes relevant to this band of resistance is that they become visible across many different ways. They become visible in our cities. They become audible. It's horns. It's people going around like screaming and shouting and calling for change. They become visible through the apps that have invisibilized them, right? They come they become visible by their absence. They become visible by their absence. So when you can't order that food when you're really hungry, or when the delivery fee is crazy high because there's not enough workers, that is the workers becoming visible again. And that's a big part of what is they're trying to achieve with the strikes that are happening. Because I think people aren't really aware of the conditions. They aren't really aware of the pay. And I think if people were more aware, there's a significant group of people that would perhaps, you know, choose to behave slightly differently. Where the companies have got us over a barrel is that, because if you're the customer and I'm the worker, my fortune is tied to you ordering. So, you know, as good Marxist scholars will always know, like, consumer action is never going to be the thing that changes the world. But they've really tied the hands of a consumer boycott, because consumer boycott just means workers can't eat. So figuring out a path towards effective resistance that takes that into account is really challenging.
I think the point about the invisibilization, deliberate invisibilization of the worker, and how the worker can make themselves visible again is really important. Is like really, really important, and I think bears underlining, because I think that particularly the little, and I understand the point of a tracker on a delivery app, like, and also there's only so human you can make that tracker, but it looks like a really old phone game, the way that you see the kind of the little bike kind of sort of hopping along.
It's like Snake,
a map. Yeah. It does look like Snake, and whether it's sort of deliberate to make that seem as kind of gamified as possible.
And it gamifies it the other way. That's what you see as a worker as well, right? You get it. Think of the view you get as a worker when you get offered a job. It's usually a map with no scale on it. So you have to know the city to know really how far away two points are. Before that, you end up on these long jobs for hardly any money. You get shown a map and then oftentimes a price. and that's all you see. And then it's like following Google Maps along the street or in your car, right? You follow the blue line broadly to the place that you're going to. As you become a better rider, you turn that off and you just cycle there because you know exactly where you're going and all the shortcuts. And it's actually that element of being kind of more skilled is part of what makes this work survivable. And that gamification is a big part of it. So for example, you know, and this is again the way that I try and use this to push back against the platform's arguments. So Deliveroo's KPI used to be from the point of order through to the point of delivery is 34 minutes, right? So from the time you just press order on your phone to it actually the knock on the door. And most orders satisfied that. To be able to deliver a meal 1 mile in 20 minutes, say, you don't have to be very good. You don't have to be a good cyclist. You might even be able to walk it, you know, and stop at all the red lights. But they're only going to pay you £2.80 for it. So you don't have to be skilled to do the work on their terms. But if you actually want to be able to survive, you have to be skilled. You have to know where the corners are that you can cut. You have to know where you can weave through traffic. You have to know which restaurants are going to have the quickest pickup times, which buildings are going to be the quickest to deliver to. That's the only way you can actually make this a meaningful form of financial kind of gain. So yes, to do the work at its most basic level, if you actually didn't need money, you don't have to be all that kind of good at it. But if you do need the money, which 99.9% of these workers do, then you have to be good at it. And sometimes you push it too far and you fall off, or you hit somebody going through a red light, or the bad things happen that you occasionally see in the news. And that's purely because workers don't want to do that. Like, it never used to happen when the pay was better. It's not like a natural way of doing the job. Nobody wants to throw their life away for a pizza. But faced with these declining wages and declining conditions, it feels like the only option that's left.
It's also worth sort of thinking about how it, like, from like my observations of how, because I used to work in a place where I think it was very similar to how you described it, like lots of offices and therefore lots of sort of like Deliveroo, Uber Eats, like a lot of like cycles everywhere. And one thing I used to always be quite fascinated about was just like how the dominance of these platforms, and also just like the normalization of like, yeah, you should get like a massive like lunch being delivered by, you know, one cyclist, right? And that should be happening like multiple times a week, because that's just how, like, you know, the line goes up, for like lack of a better term. But how that has sort of like also changed the way that we think about like open space and the way that we think about geography, right? And so when I see delivery cyclists who like run red lights, for example, or like really put themselves in quite a lot of danger because they need to sort of hit particular targets, because as you mentioned, like the way that you make money on here is not really about like doing a set number of jobs and kind of like receiving, and that sort of fitting in within like the broader context of flexibility, which is how, again, like how these apps still sell themselves. But it's much more about, well, if you want to make money on here, then you actually do have to take on a lot more risk to your personal life in order to do so. And that's just like the way that things are, and the fact that like are kind of like, you know, in every city and pretty much every town, it sort of feels as if like that consensus has sort of been tacitly accepted. I don't know whether that's actually the right way of putting it, but it seems to sort of be like a much more normalized way of doing things. And like, I wondered whether you had any thoughts about how you sort of see these types of environments and how they've changed, and whether like the ways in which they've changed in terms of things feeling a lot smaller, feeling a lot more claustrophobic, but also like it just being very clear that like like the way in which like day-to-day life functions in these places are ones where you have a class of people who are basically like, who basically may not come home that evening because of the amount of risk that they have sort of been coerced into taking in order to sort of make a living in a place where like it is very difficult to do anything other than that. Yeah, I know that was like a bit of a ramble, but I wondered whether like you had any thoughts about how cities have sort of like adapted and like the ways in which policymaking in cities has sort of, you know, been really from what I've read and like from what I've seen, really been at the favor of companies who kind of accept at this point that like, yeah, you know, the way that our businesses work do depend on a certain number of people really being able to accept that they could either be permanently injured or just die at any point. And it's not even just like physical stuff, like, you know, being hit by a car or something, but it's also just like the amount of like health, like the sort of the sort of health, and you know, not like mental health, but also the physical health of like these drivers as well, or these cyclists as well. Like in the Vittles piece, Callum talks about how a lot of the cyclists like can't actually afford to eat the hot meals that they're delivering anymore. And so they have to sort of rely on kind of like convenience food from like, you know, your Tesco Expresses or like frozen meals if they're lucky. So like the fact that this type of job really requires you to relinquish so much of yourself, even if you aren't like, even if you're very careful, like not to sort of be like not experience a fatality on the road, like what is happening to you physiologically is also quite significant. You are taking on so much stress. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that makes any sense, but
totally, totally. I mean, it resonates with it. You know, even when I was doing this work, me and others that I worked with would finish a lunch shift, not able to really buy ourselves a lunch with the money that we'd earn if we still wanted to pay our rent, all those kind of things. And so it was a contingent of us that would go and eat Hare Krishna food in the kind of last 10 minutes before they'd leave at the end of the lunch rush, right? Without them, there's many, many, many workers that would have gone without a hot meal, without a substantial meal in the middle of the day. So for people that don't know, Hare Krishna food is like free. They often come up with these like big kind of bins of very carbohydrate rich, really good filling food. And yeah, many, many workers, myself included, have to eat there, not necessarily out of choice, but it's the only way to do that and then make your money cut far enough into paying your bills and all those kind of things, especially if you have like an accident and then you have to pay for bike maintenance. Well, then you can't afford food. So you have to eat somewhere else, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, in terms of physiologically, I mean, as a cyclist, I burnt 7,000 or I burnt like 5,000 calories a day. So to maintain, I would have to eat 7,000 calories a day to just stay the same weight. Food's expensive, especially when you have to eat that much of it. So there's this kind of myth that also circulates, oh, doing this work will keep you fit. But really, all you can afford is Snickers and chips. Do you know what I mean? That's all I ate for a while for dinner. There's a chip shop in Marylebone that I would go to and have a king-size Snickers and a portion of chips. And that would just be a way to get calories in a way that is cheap. Because for £2, you can, you know, do that kind of eating that allows you to reproduce your labor further. In terms of changes to the city, do you guys remember the Shadwell house fire? This starts off a bit tenuous. But do you remember the Shadwell house fire?
Yeah.
So that started with a battery for a bike, right? Going wrong. Cheap battery bought online that while it was charging caught fire and unfortunately led to like, you know, this huge fire in these kind of dormitory style rooms where lots of people were living in very, very close quarters. Part of the reason for the proliferation of electric bikes in the city, you might have noticed recently, a lot more of the people that were cyclists will be riding electric bikes to do this delivery, is the algorithm favors them because it thinks they're quicker. But because those conversion kits or electric bikes are very, very expensive and fees are very, very low, what we're seeing more and more is that people are buying these kind of off-brand versions, you know, made very cheaply, not certified. And this is what happened here. It was a platform worker who had a cheap electric bike battery that he needed to do in order to be able to access the money he needed to be able to survive. And when we talk about survival here, what we're talking about is living in a dorm with eight other people. It's not like having your own place, you know what I mean? And that caught fire. The companies that set these agendas have blood on their hands, as far as I'm concerned, with relation to that kind of incident. And it won't be the only one that happens, you know? But that link got lost in the press and in the media surrounding it. But if it wasn't for the way that algorithm structures work and payment, that guy wouldn't have had to have had the cheap knockoff rubbish electric conversion for his bike, and that building would never have burnt down. It's crazy the kind of domino effect that happens with these kind of things, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very aware that we're running very close to time. So I do have like a couple of final questions for you, and I think we might have to wrap up. Well, my question was sort of much more kind of practical one at this point. One of them is a kind of sort of just sort of curiosity, which is, have there been any problems that you're aware of with stuff like union busting and fractures between people who are doing it as a kind of a sort of pocket money and people who are doing it to survive? Because presumably someone who's doing it for pocket money is quite a good mole. presumably. And is that something which has been an issue in this regard? Or again, are these companies less like, yeah, okay, fine. Okay.
Briefly, there was a thing that came out a while ago within a worker chat where a guy posted that he had been sharing information with the platform, screen grabs, names, all this kind of stuff, kind of back channeling discussion that had been going on in private worker conversations, and that platforms had been paying him for that information. Yes. So it certainly was happening. I would be libelous to say, I'm sure, but I would be deeply surprised if it's not happening anywhere still. Mm-hmm. I think you could say that. Is that allowed? Without getting totally fucking sued.
So
I think it's all right.
If you'd like to. Okay. Yeah. No. I suppose that's just a kind of sort of occupational hazard of this kind of organizing. I just wondered how prevalent it was in this particular arena. But I suppose it's everywhere, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, we've also had evidence where people, you know, the early days of GDPR when the companies were still scared, people put in GDPR requests, subject access requests for all their data. And some of the union organizers I know got their data back with emails in between executives at the firm saying, this name, this rider number is a known union organizer causing us problems. If anything comes up in his account, do fire him immediately. So we know that kind of information circulates as well. So we know they've got their eyes on people all the time, both inside and outside. And it's trying to make sure you can organize regardless of it, I suppose, and being careful at the same time, because you know, we already talked about the vulnerability of many of these workers. People can't afford to be outed if they're renting an account because they have no papers, you know?
Yeah.
They can't afford that. They don't want to end up in the Rwanda plan. We shouldn't be putting them in a position where they have to feel the risk to do that.
No, absolutely.
But yeah, it makes it a very careful negotiation, bringing everybody with you when you're trying to do this and make sure everyone's on the same page.
It's really key. And of course, that ties into the sort of the general urban planning catastrophe of there being nowhere to go, because where do you go if you want to organize, if you're not hanging around outside a restaurant in a city center, and you don't want to be somewhere outside, and you don't necessarily want to be somewhere where it's going to cost you a lot of money to be there for a longish period of time, where do you go? So the third space catastrophe is also presumably something which inflects labor organizing in a serious way. And my final question, which was again much more of a kind of sort of practical one, which is you make the very important point that these companies work in a very certain way, which means that consumer boycotts do not hurt them. It means that they hurt the workers, which is obviously not something which either we on the show or I assume our listeners, apart from the one or two disgruntled management consultants that might be a bit more concerned about it. How do you support these strikes? How do you, if you're not a member of this group of workers, how is this something that you can get not necessarily involved with, but how is this something that you can support without just fucking them over?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few clear ways. First off, look for the strike funds. So IWGB have one. If you type in like IWGB strike fund, there's one into Google, it'll come up. You can drop anything into there, a pound, 50p, £1,000 would be even better, but like anything is going to help. Because again, it allows for supporting that bridge, you know, between making it something people can and can't afford. For me, the argument is don't stop using these firms. But if you can afford to have an iced latte delivered to your house after Sunday morning yoga, you can afford to tip the driver that delivered it. Tip them in cash. You know, it goes direct into their hands. It's going to be the difference between them being able to take their kids to the cinema or being able to pay for food for that week or pay their rent or pay their bills. So if you're using these services, cool. Just make sure you put a little bit extra in those workers' hands to do that. And then when there are strikes, write to the companies, say you're pissed off, say you're annoyed, say that you want to see workers do better. If there are alternatives that pay better, then use them. you know, if there are alternatives in your area, then try and use those. Chat to workers. You know, often it's much easier with a cab than it is with food delivery. But, you know, do you enjoy working for Uber? Or do you prefer working for Bolt? Or do you prefer working for XYZ, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you hear the same answer from those workers lots and lots of times, use that one. Because the chances are all the workers are on all of them. just they might get a slightly bigger slice of the pie from one at certain times. So try and, you know, listen to what people are saying and use those. Write to your MP. That's another one. You know, I have long conversations with MPs about what we need to be doing here. Some of it, I think, sinks in, and then you see what happens in the manifesto meetings, and then you think, nothing sank in. But alas, we're trying, and I think we are trying to hit that kind of critical mass of more people that are doing it, you know. But yeah, and just like if you see somebody go through a red light, don't take their picture and put it on Twitter and say this happened at this time. And I'm not saying that's anything you guys are going to do, but it's something that definitely does happen.
Yeah.
Just take a minute to think this is somebody that's just trying to get out of work with enough to feed themselves at the end of the day. It's nothing personal. I know it's not ideal, but it's, you know, sometimes if you do that and somebody gets fired, that's it, they're toast.
Yeah.
And it's so important to remember that this kind of what should be quite a kind of nebulous idea of kind of customer satisfaction, but which is actually just a measure of the customer's mood or their kind of general character on sort of any given day. Like I have never given less than a 5-star rating for anything. Yeah. It sort of doesn't matter. An Uber driver could nearly kill me and they're still getting 5 stars. It's still not important enough to deny this person their wages. So that's something that's really important. And I'm really glad that you said about tipping in cash, because I am a keep cash crank. And like whenever you bring this up, people are just like, oh, so do you think that like it's because do you think that it's because Bill Gates is watching you? And it's like, no, it's not that. It's literally for stuff like this. It's because there's an entire kind of sector of society, and it's not just precarious workers, it's homeless people as well, it's older people, it's people who don't have great English, it's immigrants who are functionally disenfranchised by the insistence on no one having cash and nowhere taking cash. And like it makes me very, very upset that this has been kind of got hold of and colonized by a very, very particular kind of mad person, because it actually is important. It's important to keep cash, and you should have cash with you.
Yeah, I agree. Totally on the same page. A pound today is a pound tomorrow is a pound the day afterwards, and the government doesn't have to see what happens to it. So when, you know, you're dealing with people that might not have very secure circumstances, it is the difference. Yeah, cash is still king.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also keep a cash reserve in a shoebox, actually.
Hussein, stop telling people about your cash shoebox.
Off you can. I'm the same.
I think
under the mattress.
I think on that note, it's probably a good place to end. Adam, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for sharing your research and insights with us. If people want to read your work or like sort of keep up to date with the type of work you're doing, is there a way that they can do that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, X, whatever the hell. So please do get in touch. Or if not, if you just like Google Adam Badger, my email address comes up. Please do get in touch. I'm always keen to chat to anybody and everybody wants to talk about these kind of things. So yeah, do come say hi.
Yeah, and no doubt that we'll probably be revisiting this at some point in the near future. And we'd love to have you back on for when we do that. Until then, thank you very much for listening to this episode of 10,000 Posts. We have lots of good bonus content on our Patreon if you want to consider supporting our show. It's $5 a month, and it also helps us to do the show independently and without ads. We also have, you know, by subscribing, you can also access our Discord server, which is a new thing that it's a new thing. Join it. We've got a good community there. There'll be some fun stuff that happens there pretty soon. This show is produced by Devon. Follow them at Devon_Unearth. Listen to Kill James Bond if you don't already. And in terms of like plugs from the show, there will be links to Gaza Appeals. Please do consider donating if you haven't done so. Also, please continue going to protests, especially now especially considering everything going on, showing up to a protest more important than ever. Phoebe, do you have any plugs?
You can subscribe to my Substack, and we will also put a link to the strike fund that Adam was mentioning earlier in the notes. Yeah. So it's going to be a very dense set of notes for this episode. So you know, do have a look at that.
Yeah, good idea. Well, thank you so much, Adam, once again. And until next time, we will catch you all later. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.